Okay, so next on the program is Martin Brody, who is a composer at Wellesley College. And he's the recipient of a lot of awards from Guggenheim Foundation, the American Academy of Arts and Letters, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and others. And he served as composer in residence at the American Academy in Rome in 2001, and various other places as well where he was composer in residence. He's worked as a film and TV composer and a composer of concert music, and he's currently writing his third chamber opera. He's also written a lot on contemporary music and serves on a lot of boards. So he's going to talk to us with a different title, which is now Vocal Turbulence in Modern Opera Choruses, Crowd Noise. Correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you for
welcome to Martin.
Thank you very much, and thank you for to everyone for the papers so far today, and I think we're going to hopefully get an extension of some of the things that have already come up. So I want to begin with a scream and a shout. The scream is from Schoenberg's opera Moses and Aaron, and the shout is maybe a little more famous. It's from the Bach St. Matthew Passion. So here's the scream. That's the chorus of the Komische Oper, and they are in the guise of the chosen people. So I'm going to give you about a minute of context for that now. Right before that, the 70 elders of the people of Israel in the desert are getting very upset about the fact that Moses has disappeared for 40 days and 40 nights. This is the first scene of Act Two of the opera, and we're going to hear a little bit of them, and then it'll go into the screen, just about a minute total, so you hear what that whoops sounds like. Sorry. Back to here's the shout. Oops, one more time, sorry. And here's a little bit of the context of the shout. We're going to hear Pontius Pilate, this is the gospel, of course, we're going to hear Pontius Pilate say, who do you want to save, Jesus or Barabbas? And then we're going to hear the evangelist say, and they said, and then the shout, and then Pontius Pilate will say, and what do you want to do about that? Okay. So, these eruptions of vocal turbulence frame a story that I want to tell about vowels and consonants, noise and pitch, structure and color, cognition and sensation, modernism and crowds. My primary concern in this paper will be to construct a phenomenology and semiotics of the scream, the first of the two, to consider how this noise was defined as music, or perhaps better to say as a rendering of music's other, an anti-music latent in Schoenberg's contingent atonal structures. This is the purview of the modern opera chorus, a frightening collective with a knack for splitting the difference between pitch and noise, vowel and consonant, meaning and mayhem. When a chorus turns into a mob before our ears and eyes, it turns on music itself and violates the representational conventions of opera. In this talk, I'll focus on the moment when the chorus in Moses and Aaron turns into a mob and what this has to do with the opera's 12-tone structure, the composer's ideas about artistic subjectivity and psychoacoustics, and the social environment of modern music writ large. I'll juxtapose the roar of Schoenberg's folk with the composer's anxious ideas about the sensation of tone and the emancipation of the dissonance. I want to suggest that for Schoenberg, among others, the collective voice became a heuristic for thinking unsettling thoughts about the medium, message, and structure of music. With this in mind, I'll juxtapose Elias Canetti's description of the mass drive, or instinct, with the turbulent voices of a few opera choruses, and I'm very grateful to Eustace already for helping me a little bit with this. Finally, I'll compare the scream with Bach's shout, an example that can be understood as the complement under inversion, so to speak, of the Schoenberg example, a performance of collective empathy that remediates the pathology of the mob. The purpose of these juxtapositions is not to homogenize the critical terms involved or produce a unified theory, but rather to accrete meanings, mind the gaps, and sharpen musical experiences. There are plenty of rowdy crowds in opera. Few represent modern crowds or especially model their sound. When the supplications of the 16th century Russian peasants in the opening of Mussorgsky's Boris Godunov turn from a self-reflexive performance of generic folk music to a roar ensemble cry, we may momentarily hear the discharge of a modern mob. And I'll play you just about 30 seconds or so of that generic folk music that they sing, and then something that they do about a minute later. Okay, and this is a supplication. You can see the text, I guess, there, you know, why do you abandon us, oh, our father, and all that. And it's a supplication to Boris Godunov, who is the Russian regent, who has not yet decided to assume the throne. And they're kind of egged on then by a police chief who says, you know, kind of sing it better, you know, you're not doing well enough. And then they get really worked up, and in the middle of the second time through that, they sing this. Peasants' high register quasi-yodeling and intense melismas strain the larynx and stretch the unison voice of the crowd to a physical limit. The embodied medium of communication is distressed. The codes of identity dissolve into a collective roar that exceeds the apparent limits of harmony, musical expression, and ensemble propriety. The furious crowd in Turandot presents a more ambivalent modernism and a more subtle kind of boundary condition. The opera begins with a cascade of exotic orchestral sound, a mandarin sober incantation announcing a public execution, and a flash of choral turbulence. And here is the beginning of the very beginning of the opera, and a little bit of what the mandarin says, which is down there at the bottom of the screen. Thank you. bloodlust forecast in the sounds of the orchestral introduction with its battery of exotic percussion instruments spills into the instrumental music that accompanies the baritone voice of the Mandarin. Then it erupts in a flurry of intense choral singing. Excited by the baritone's announcement, the chorus performs a tight, bloodthirsty vocal paroxysm. And I'll play you that. And this is number two and number three of the texts. That last solo voice is the young Joan Sutherland in the 50s. This is the Callas performance, but she's not going to show up for a while, so we don't get her. Even as they roar in unison and bump up against the top of their tessitura, this exotic chorus maintains a degree of vocal decorum. Their succinct homicidal cries show off their good diction. Their fury is squeezed into a sequence of breathless mini-phrases, terse melodic fragments, and harmonies that are unstable, but that erupt neatly in two-measure units. After less than 20 seconds of this stylized collective agitation, a bunch of tenors, the Imperial Guards, step in. Order is restored in the tonal universe, the harmonic markers and rhetoric of Orientalism subside, the music sinks into a stable key, and the fairy tale mob suddenly seems more like a Verismo crowd. The sopranos discharge full-throated sighs as they implore the tenors to show them mercy, and they speak the unembellished language of Italian realism, crudeli, they explain, I miei bambini, o madre mia, and so forth. Mixing verismo with the opera's signature orientalism modulates the sound of the crowd from the realm of remote myth to the representation of a more immediate world. However unsympathetic he might have been with the workers' movements surging up in the factories of Turin in the early 1920s, Puccini must have been attuned to the expressive force of referencing crowds and power for theatrical effect. And the affective transferences from the orchestra to the Mandarin to the chorus parallel the transactions between a composer, the opera's performers, and an audience that has quite suddenly been urged to identify with a chorus of Chinese citizens from a legendary past. In both of these examples, the music presents a stratified and dynamic representational structure, a downshifting from rarefied or conventional modes of theatrical representation to a more raw kind of collective vocal presence, a sound that evokes indeterminacy and physical stress, and a musical rhetoric that conveys immediacy. In both examples, the shift in the mode of vocalization or the apparatus of representation makes the phenomenon of dissolving individuality and merging into a crowd audible and credible, an artistic expression of what Elias Canetti called, quote, the full-blooded, actually this is a character, I should say, in the book Auto da Fe that we heard a little bit about before, the full-blooded warm animal in all of us. Here is his description of the mass soul from his 1935 novel, Auto da Fe, which, as Eustace said, was also, and very appropriately for my purposes, called the Tower of Babel in English. We wage the so-called war of existence for the destruction of the mass soul in ourselves no less than for hunger and love. In certain circumstances, it can become so strong as to force the individual to selfless acts or even acts contrary to his own interests. Mankind has existed as a mass for long before it was conceived of and watered down into an idea. It foams, a huge, wild, full-blooded, warm animal in all of us, very deep, far deeper than the maternal. This warm animal that was embedded in the psyche, even more deeply than the maternal bond, could be expressed by a voice that was not intimate, singular, or erotic, but rather feral and collective. As I will argue, Schoenberg theorized both the erotic solo voice and the noisy, anarchic collective voice as music limit conditions. If the realization of rarefied music, of a rarefied music of pure sensation, produced by the individual voice briefly seemed like an artistic raison d'etre, the noisy sounds of an ungovernable collective eventually came to drown it out and to require a more austere reaction from Schoenberg. In The Scream of the Folk, by the way, Moses standing over there at the Schoenberg U-Bahn stop in Berlin, this was an advertisement from the production of Moses and Aaron that they did. And there's the chorus again from the actual production. In The Scream of the Folk, in Moses and Aaron, the expression of the mass soul undermines the conditions of music altogether. Like the chosen people who have followed Moses into the desert, sound has lost its way. It has wandered into the wilderness, where it explodes in a place beyond the established boundaries of musical expression. This sonic eruption is singularly indeterminate, the only musical event in an opera score that can be named but not notated, identified only in a frantic stage direction. And this is the direction. Noise, wailing, and howling ever louder come suddenly nearer in enraged excitement. A shrieking crowd crashes onto the stage from all directions. And that's what we heard before. That's the final event in the first scene of the second act of the opera. The shrieking crowd has waited 40 days and night for its leader to return. To appreciate this uniquely anarchic sound, I want to focus on a passage that occurs 112 measures before the scream. This is the Zwischenspiel between the two completed acts of Moses and Aaron. It's an etude in whispered invertible counterpoint that compulsively recycles variations on an anxious question, where is Moses, while probing the edges between singing and speaking. It's a rendering of music straying into a phonic desert, a dry place where pitches erode into noise, vowels and consonants collide, and structures break down, where a chorus turns into a mob and singing turns towards screaming. 700 measures later, there will be a human sacrifice. So here is this entr'acte between the first and second act. It's about 2 minutes long. I'm going to spend about 5 or 10 minutes now running through this in a certain amount of detail, so I hope, bear with me. We 12-tone composers can't stop ourselves when it comes to this stuff. Here, as always, it's easy to be mesmerized by the efficacy of Schoenberg's technique. What I want to focus on is the ambivalent interplay of constructive and deconstructive elements. In this brief passage, Schoenberg weaves 12-tone counterpoint into a Baroque polyphonic texture. At the same time, language and pitch evaporate and noise prevails. In the first sung music of the entr'acte, which is in measures 5 through 7, the opera's source 12-tone set appears in the guise of a fugue-like subject and counter-subject. And this is a little bit of the score, and the vocal parts in the middle there actually show where they are, and I'll play this very brief clip. So that bum, 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 bum at the top that the sopranos are singing is actually like a fugue subject, and then there's a counter subject against that. And then there's a third line of Sprechstimme, which is this thing that Schoenberg did quite a lot of, a kind of speech, inflected speech at the same time. So the two sung lines are sung by mezzo-sopranos and tenors. Each part includes six pitch classes, includes six pitch classes. This balanced disposition of the pitch classes of the 12-tone set is a norm of Schoenberg's musical universe, but unusually, the two hexachords are formed from an asymmetrical partitioning of the set, and they're distinct in the interval structure. And you can see that here. All I'm saying is that the red notes are the notes that are the subject, and the black notes in the second line, and the row is still in order there, but the notes that are still black are the ones that are the counter subject, and they're just not the first six and the second six. He just grabs them. Now, there are a couple of reasons why he grabs those particular ones, but the first three red ones and the last three red ones are the same chord under inversion and transposition, but the main thing that I want to make is he's just grabbing these notes. So that the order in a certain sense is already getting garbled, and the conventions, this chorus is already beginning to behave in a kind of a antisocial way in a certain respect. Nonetheless, the composite rhythm of the two parts presents the normal order of the set. It's still the same order, and the contrapuntal arrangement underscores the different structures and character of the subject and the counter-subject. There's a lot of structure here, and this is my main point, as I said, but no single governing principle. When the chorus sings the set in two-part counterpoint, they rip the structure apart, and nothing stops them. There's no court of nature. There's no dissonance resolution. There's no commander-in-chief. There's almost no sensus communis at all in this, but rather just a highly contingent structure, 12 notes in a row. In the third line of counterpoint, the second counter-subject presented in the mumbling Sprechstimme causes further problems. Paradoxically, as the texture unfolds and the form comes into focus, the orderly imitative relationships of the parts superimposes speech and singing in a way that increasingly garbles the text, as well as jumbling the pitch structure's order. Sound and meaning are engaged in a war fought over the phonemes, which function neither as an effective instrument for shaping the vocal tract as a rich resonant environment, nor as a medium for articulating intelligible information. As the entr'acte continues, the number of vocal parts expands and the war between sound and sense escalates. I'll talk you through just a little bit of this. After the first statement, the structure of the subject and two counter-subjects returns in toto in invertible counterpoint at the pitch level of the original statement's combinatorial complement. I'm sorry, I'm getting this a little bit of 12-tone lingo here, but the main thing is that it comes back and it's inverted. Actually, I'm sorry, I was going to go through this slide before this point, but this just shows you what actually happens, and you can see that some of the notes, when they get segregated out, get repeated in the lower part, so that starts to actually jumble the original order of the notes, which for Schoenberg is a big deal. And then we see that there are two different texts at the same time that are sounding. So it's like a motet with several different lines of text going on at the same time, but here with far more kind of unresolved information, I would argue. As the entr'acte continues, the number of vocal parts expands and the war between sound and sense escalates, I said. So the next time around, we hear the same thing, and actually you can almost kind of see here that the basses have that, there's only a tiny little bit of the score here, but they're going down in exactly the opposite direction that the sopranos went up, and they're beginning another statement. So I'll just play that again. So actually what we've had is just a multiplication of voices coming in and superimposing different kinds of information on top of each other. The polyphony of the six-voice texture intensifies again at the beginning of the second section of the passage in measure 20, when the subject and counter-subject and its echo and invertible counterpoint are superimposed in a canon. Meanwhile, the Sprechstimme, now whispered by altos and basses, snaps into its own strict canonic pattern. And again, another very short example. So as you can see, as we go along, there's just more stuff, and it's more jumbled. If the whispered consonants in this entr'acte threaten to bring down the firm edifice, that was a good one, of 12-tone counterpoint and neo-Baroque polyphony, they also provide the raw material for a profane temple of noise. From the outset of the entr'acte, the mouths of the chorus become an efficient apparatus for producing a palette of unpitched sounds, labiodental and palliative fricatives, digraphs, bilabial nasals, uvular and velar stopped consonants. In the first four measures alone, there are a dozen different consonants. After introducing an array of consonants ad seriatim, Schoenberg constructs a mini taxonomy of noise chords, noise molecules, so to speak, constructed from the chorus's atomic consonants. As the nodal point of the passage, pitch sounds momentarily clear out altogether to lay bare a three-voice Sprechstimme canon. And you can see that it's the same text here, and it's actually the same contour. This lasts about 2 seconds, but you can almost hear a little canon. It's fast. We'll do it one more time. Whoops, no, we won't. We'll go back. One more time. It takes a while to hear that one, but there's a little canon in there. The subject of the canon is a spoken sentence comprised of 9 syllables, each but one of which begins with a different consonant, so that they actually line up to form chords of different consonants. The staggered speech canon produces a sequence of chords or intervals on 7 consecutive half beats, each comprised of a different combination of consonants. For a narrow couple of seconds, Schoenberg demonstrates a contrapuntal dystopia of noise. Throughout the entr'acte, noises become more structurally articulate as vowels dissolve into consonants and pitches into noise. Harmony, counterpoint, and intelligible speech are collateral damage. In producing this destructive miracle in the desert, the density of consonants, the speed of attacks, and the passage's brisk tempo, a function of the crowd's panic, are primary factors. Only the first three notes of the repeated fugue subject, sung on the cry, ni, 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 have the open vowel and ample duration for full-bodied choral singing. Sharpening the focus of the first three pitches of the subject props up the otherwise sagging polyphonic structure. There is, however, no question that the tempo will collapse. Throughout this passage, consonant notes fly by quickly and articulately, but the vowels are choked out. There are, for example, 25 consonants articulated in the first 8 beats of the opening of the entr'acte at quarter equals 88 beats per second, or per minute, that'd be 88 beats per minute, roughly 5 ensemble consonant sounds are produced per second. In the ensuing choral music, especially when the chorus sings 16th notes at a pace of roughly 1/6 of a second each, the syllabic peaks, where vowels and pitches come into focus, versus their noisy consonant onsets, are attenuated almost to a vanishing point. The setting of a consonant-rich, melodically intricate, and rhythmically compressed sentence in measure 11 and 12, for example, is too fast and too varied for the mezzos to squeak out much in the way of vowels and pitches, let alone syllables and words, and they're surrounded by all sorts of other stuff going on. I'll just play that one little bit. This is the right example. If you are just even following the sentence there, it's very hard. You can just pick out little bits of that coming through in that. There are 10 syllables, 10 pitches and pitch classes, and 13 consonants in 2 seconds. And then in another 2 seconds of music, the last two notes of the set appear, followed by a retrograde of the second hexachord and a full restatement of the sentence of the text. Just a lot of information, right? The force of this compression all but annihilates the mechanics of singing. Both singing and Sprechstimme head into a phonically liminal space where noise prevails. As I've already mentioned, when this line of text recurs in the Sprechstimme canon in Measure 18, it is an unsung voice that produces a new set of noise structures out of the ashes of pitch. The dissolving of pitch into noise in Moses and Aaron models the ascendancy of the crowd. It also pessimistically mimics a couple of theoretical possibilities for the future of music that Schoenberg had presented more than 10 years before the opera was written. In the closing arguments of his 1910 Harmony Lyra, he proposed that the transmutation of pitch into color was a way to bring us, as he said, closer to the illusory stuff of our dreams. This would occur when composers threw off the shackles of consonants, and now I mean consonants as in consonants and dissonance, not with a TS, but a C-E-M-E-N. This would occur when composers threw off the shackles of consonants and dissonance and investigated the full range of sensations of the tone, all of the partial vibrations of the standing wave. Here's the argument in brief. This is what Schoenberg said. Will be a series of quotes. It is certain that the overtones all contribute more or less that of the acoustical emanations of the tone, that of the acoustical emanations of the tone, nothing is lost, and the world of feeling somehow takes into account the entire complex. So tone and pitch, tone color and pitch are on a continuum. Another passage, tone color is the main topic, pitch a subdivision. Pitch is nothing else but tone color measured in one direction. So if harmony and melody are derived from exploring the gamut of partial vibrations of the standing wave, that is by translating color into pitch, a reciprocal process might also be possible, a kind of additive synthesis whereby shifts of color would be triggered by rearranging combinations of pitches. And this is a slightly longer quote, the last one. If it is possible to create patterns out of tone colors that are differentiated according to pitch, patterns we call melodies, then it must also be possible to make such progressions out of what we simply call tone color, progressions whose relations with one another work with a kind of logic entirely equivalent to that logic which satisfies us in the melody of pitches. Dissonant harmony would be governed by a new phenomenology of sound and a yet undiscovered melodic logic of tone colors rather than fixed conditions of consonance and dissonance and tonal hierarchy. In an essay written in 1908 for the Blaue Reiter, The Relationship of the Text, Schoenberg suggested that the human voice was the ideal instrument to project emancipated sound, especially when singing was liberated from the burden of outward correspondences, that is, expressing the meaning of words. By lingering on pitched vowels, combining tones and phonemes to reshape the infinitely malleable vocal track, the voice became the medium of an inward correspondence. More radical tone color music than the Klangfarben melody produced by chords made out of pitches. So this is a little quote from that essay. The outward correspondence between music and text, as exhibited in declamation, tempo, and dynamics, has but little to do with the inward correspondence and belongs to the same stage of primitive imitation of nature as the copying of a model. Apparently superficial divergences can be necessary because of parallelism on a higher level. Therefore, the judgment on the basis of the text is just as reliable as the judgment of albumen according to the characteristics of carbon. The living material, the sonorous albumen of music, gestates in the mouth. By contrast, mimesis was a primitive and maybe even inhumane technology. Schoenberg's radical speculation about sound led to a choice between two epistemological limits. On the one hand, a music of voices without meaning and sensations without structure. On the other, a new structural order made of tone colors made possible by embracing contingency, what he called an extended truce between nature and culture that might yet produce its own kind of logic. The music theorist Benjamin Stege has noted that Schoenberg swung from what he called petulant irrationalism to cool pragmatism as he struggled with the enigma of pure sensation and contingent structures during the period when he composed his theory of harmony and wrote his first atonal pieces. Writing to Busoni in 1908, Schoenberg made the case for a musical unlogic of unmediated sensation, contrary to the hope for a kind of logic entirely equal to the logic which satisfies us in the melody of pitches. which is what he imagined just months later in the Harmony Lyra. So from the letter to Busoni, this variegation, this multifariousness, this unlogic our sensations display, this unlogic which the associations exhibit, which reveal some rising surge of blood, some sensory or nervous reaction, I would like to have this in my music. It should be the expression of sensation, as sensation really is, which brings us into connection with our unconscious, and not a changeling of sensations and conscious logic. So, there are any number of reasons that Schoenberg might have backed away from this radical agenda. Not least would have been the lesson that had been forced upon me, as he said, during the year 1920, in a famous letter to Kandinsky, as he described it. It is that I am not a German, not a European, indeed perhaps scarcely even a human being. At least the Europeans prefer the worst of their race to me, but I am a Jew. For Schoenberg, anti-Semitism was perhaps above all the denial of the individual and the ascendancy of what he called the community of the lump. In Moses and Aaron, he modeled this dystopic Gemeinschaft, this inverted Gemeinschaft, and its lethal unlogic of the senses. 2 years later, 20 years later, Schoenberg, now an expatriate, revisited the question of sensation and structure in a lecture on 12-tone music, which he delivered at Princeton in 1934. In the 12-tone lecture, both the petulant irrationality and the cool pragmatism of 1910 had given way to an altogether mosaic project, to embrace contingency but resist the crowd by emulating the oneness of God and making order out of chaos. And as he put it in that essay, the lecture that became the essay, Composition with 12 Tones, the concept of creator and creation should be formed in harmony with the divine model. Inspiration and perfection, wish and fulfillment, will and accomplishment would thus coincide spontaneously and simultaneously. Schoenberg recycled his argument about the sensations of the tone from his 1910 harmony book, but not to conjure the stuff of our dreams, but rather to make the case for sovereign consciousness and cognitivity. And he wrote, in my Harmony Lyra, I presented the theory that dissonant tones appear later among the overtones, for which reason the ear is less intimately acquainted with them. Now, however, to become intimate with the higher partials was to overcome fear, the fear of the sense-interrupting effect of so-called dissonance. Over and over in the essay on 12-tone composition, Schoenberg described the triumph of cognition and comprehension over difficulty and fear in terms of pitch structures now instead of tone color. And this is the slide which is now up. Closer acquaintance with the more remote consonances, the dissonance that is, gradually eliminated the difficulty of comprehension. The term emancipation of dissonance refers to its comprehensibility, which is considered equivalent to the consonance's comprehensibility. So it's all about pitch structures now. The inspired genius emulated God by wrestling intelligible pitch structures from the distant overtones. Once the choice was made to pursue meaning and intelligibility over unstructured sensations, dissonant harmony could be liberated, but the voice became suspect. If the solo voice's unbounded multifariousness of qualities had become a threat to intelligibility, the mouth of a mob was even more insidious. The former would produce seductive but unintelligible sound colors, the latter an unalloyed disturbance, an anti-music that would never resolve into a new order. All told, Moses and Aaron is a parable of failed vocalization and the difficulty of creating a viable relationship between sound, sense, and musical structure. Moses, the supreme commander's proxy, cannot sing. Aaron, the bel canto singer, is hardly a deep thinker. The crowd turns to noise, and the composer can't complete the opera. Schoenberg's anxieties about the breakdown of communication in an era of emancipated dissonance are muted in his self-assured prose writing, but they break through the surface of his opera in an orgy of consonants, that's with TS at the end, consonants, which are in turn a prelude to the scream. For the mob, there are two possibilities: the unthinking and unintelligible solidarity of noise, or an embrace of the atavistic sounds of reified consonants that might easily tilt into fascism. And another paper that I would like to write that would come out of this is actually about Schoenberg's response to a piece by Stravinsky that was written a few years earlier, Oedipus Rex, in which the chorus is a male chorus that is, this is exactly at the moment, by the way, when Stravinsky is praising Mussolini to the skies, and this chorus is very, very fascistic sounding, and it's, I think, very much one of the reasons why Adorno ended up writing The Philosophy of New Music and pegging Stravinsky the way he does in that. In any event, there is no escape de jouissance. Moses and Aaron, as Adorno succinctly summarized, does the absolute the honor of not pretending it is present, even as it strives metamusically to articulate the problem of representation and communication in sound and musical structures. And maybe if I have 5 more minutes, I could do a little bit of a...
Yeah, 5 more minutes.
Is that great?
Perfect.
Okay. If Schoenberg's noisy crowd insinuates a crisis of subjectivity and faith, Bach's chorus in the Matthew Passion enacts a recovery from a profane eruption of vocal turbulence, a retreat from the possibility of collective noise. Arguably, the shout is the most overexcited diminished seventh chord in the Western canon. Produced by a chorus temporarily impersonating a crowd of Jews, the shout injects a spike of unprepared and, in a sense, unresolved dissonance into the heart of a long story about a Roman prefect, a petty thief, and the Christian savior. It disrupts a tonal cadence, truncates the end of a recitative, and compromises a well-established agreement between verbal syntax, harmonic progression, and narrative conventions. In blowing up the cadence, the shout momentarily arrests the narrator's command of the surrogate voices he summons to illustrate his story, the hallmark of his sermonizing powers. Nonetheless, the preacher barely registers the uproar. He maintains his composure as if almost nothing, certainly nothing untoward, had happened, treating the shocking choral outburst in harmonic substitution and the corresponding substitution of Barabbas for Jesus in the story as if they were a regular part of the narrative apparatus, the result of a conventional tonal elision that nudges the music into the next sentence, the next sung sentence of the story. The shout might be understood as the preacher's most drastic trick, a shock effect to convey the irrepressible savagery of the mob. I prefer to think of it, I prefer to think that it intrudes unbidden by the oratorio's storyteller, not as an intended narrative contrivance, but rather as a latent memory which breaks through the sonic surface at a moment when the burden of narration becomes unbearable. The aberrant harmony, which produces stinging cross relations and a startling tritone leap in the bass, seems to come out of nowhere, or at least from another time and place. And so it does. The chord would have been intense but unexceptional if it had occurred as a pretonic harmony in E minor, the key of the oratorio's opening, which renders the Savior's ascent to the site of the crucifixion. Although it comes from a naturalistic source in the fictive world of the piece, a chorus impersonating a mob, the shout is uniquely incongruous. It defies the conventions of narration and enactment. It doesn't seem altogether realistic or supernatural. It models a psychic than a narrative, naturalistic, or supernatural event. I'd say it's a pre-modern version of a return of the repressed. It is as if a sound that the preacher cannot control has become audible to his congregation. For a second, the audience vicariously feels the pain of a witness to traumatic events rather than enjoying his virtuosity as a storyteller. So I would say sin is to Bach's evangelist, his surrogate, what contingency is to Schoenberg, an irrepressible force under the surface affecting the course of events. In many other respects, the spatial and contrapuntal dynamics of the Passion's ensemble singing are a strong precedent for Schoenberg's Moses and Aaron. The comparison extends to the solo singing as well. Schoenberg's Moses expresses himself only through Sprechstimme, Bach's evangelist exclusively through recitative. Both Moses and the evangelist employ surrogates to sing arias to the people. In Moses and Aaron, it is Aaron who intensifies the communication, and in the Matthew Passion, various solo singers step forward to illustrate the story for a congregation that itself participates in the performance by singing chorale tunes. Schoenberg's scream, however, is irrevocable. The mob has flouted the ontological conditions of musical intelligibility, and they show no signs of relenting. The third act of the opera, in which they might have regained their composure, remains unwritten, at least in part, I believe, because of the implausibility of restoring the musical covenant between this crowd and its maker once they've broken away from him and screamed. By contrast, Bach stages a complicated exercise in empathy to reveal the durability of the structures involved. If the Jewish mob's ferocity threatens to break apart the musical and verbal orders of the Passion, its dissonance, CE at the end, dissonance as opposed to consonants, resolves into a capacious tonal structure. A transcendent movement from dissonance to consonance regulates the relationship between sound and music, resonance and harmony. Tonality cradles the chorus in its subjective motility throughout the work. The collective voice can assume a range of identities and moral registers without losing its way. It can be a Jewish mob, a Messiah's disciples, and even the congregation itself, which singing along reflects on the sacrifice of a martyr, the possibility of redemption, and above all, the universality of sin. The accomplishment of Schoenberg's Grand Opera can be measured in terms of the scope of its ambitions. To finish it, Schoenberg would have needed to reconcile his ideas about the phenomenology of sound and musical structure with a new covenant between Führer and folk, or if you will, a psychic agreement between superego and id, or an existential accord between meaning and being. Succeeding in composing out his ideas about phenomenology and structure, he dramatized his inability to reconcile them with the world. This, of course, is one of the grand themes of his nemesis and great admirer, Theodor Adorno. And I'll finish just with a very short polemic of my own. The residual legacy of the opera's choral music is enough of a legacy. It's good enough. The possibility of understanding collective and vocal turbulence is a paradigm for thinking about sound, meaning, and music. An alternative to Barthes' jouissance, Pythagoras' hammers and anvils, or Cavarero's plurality of voices. What would the topography of this musical space look like? Not a sound structural hierarchy, natural or metaphysical, tonal or otherwise. Not even Schoenberg's linear spectrum of color and pitch. Not a sudden leap into the void of noise. Not an apotheosis of national identity or a nervous fear of anarchy. Neither a cloistered discharge of pleasure in the intimate exchange between voice and auditor, or a global affirmation of the voice's individuality. I hope it will not seem too facile to leave the question open and conclude by inverting the final sentence of that locus classicus for all of us, I imagine, Barthes' Grain of the Voice. Barthes' last sentence is this: were we to succeed in refining a certain aesthetics of musical pleasure, then doubtless we would attach less importance to the formidable break in tonality accomplished by modernity. My last sentence is this: were we to succeed in refining a certain aesthetics of musical turbulence, then doubtless we would attach even more importance to the formidable break with tonality accomplished by modernity. Thank you.